by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make the heaven the middle of it. Rest make the heaven the middle. We are. Rest make the heaven the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. This impeachment trial will shortly be underway next week. And I believe each side, Democrats have 24 hours Republicans have 24 hours to defend. And so basically you've got the Democratic Party that are the prosecutors, and you've got the defenders that would be on the Republican side. Like I was saying just a moment ago, you've got the Democrats who are the prosecutors, and basically the Republicans are the defenders of Trump. And so listen to this. This is an interview and actually a podcast on Greg Jarrett's site, and I'll give you the full address on our webpage. But here we go. Listen to this very carefully. It's awful. This is an awful good podcast. Here we go with Greg Jarrett.
The Impeachment Witch Hunt with Greg Jarrett.
Dripping with derision, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi exulted that President Trump has been impeached forever. They can never erase that, she intoned as she finally handed over the articles of impeachment to the U.S. Senate. If Pelosi had a football nearby, she would have spiked it. Her celebratory remarks really crystallized what the impeachment of Donald Trump is all about. Pelosi doesn't care about facts, evidence, or what constitutes an impeachable offense under the U.S. Constitution, no. She cares only about bludgeoning the president for the electoral harm it might cause come November. This has been Pelosi's intent all along. Impeachment was her political cudgel. She crowed about it like a pro wrestler who body slams an opponent, then celebrates by prancing around the ring. It was all staged, of course.
Any further evidence should not be avoided. And now the ball is in the court of the Senate.
Nobody should be fooled by Pelosi's shameless antics. She wanted to impeach Donald Trump since the moment he took office. She admitted it during a televised forum last month. It was a moment of uncommon candor for a speaker who routinely traffics in duplicity. At the same venue, she also repeated the canard she's been peddling for months. Quote, "We don't take any glee in this at all. It is heartbreaking." Right. Then why did she hand out souvenir pens like party favors when she signed the articles of impeachment in a ceremony? Pelosi then posed for photographs, holding up the commemorative pens while smiling like a Cheshire cat. So much for somber and serious. You could almost hear the champagne corks popping in the cloakroom. But don't forget, Pelosi prays for the president. Indeed, she seems obsessed with reminding us at every turn how prayerful she is. It is so sad, she keeps telling us. Sure, Nancy. In truth, Pelosi is the master of insincerity. On the eve of the House vote to impeach, she insisted that, quote, "politics is not even a consideration in this." Really? Then why did she confess that she's been yearning for impeachment since Trump moved into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue? Does anybody really believe that whopper? For months, Pelosi has insisted she would never condone a partisan impeachment. And then she engineered a partisan impeachment. Once she set the charade in motion, Pelosi insisted that impeaching Trump was a matter of urgency. He's a threat to national security and democracy. So she rushed it through the House with spurious evidence and then sat on the impeachment articles for the better part of a month and refused to transmit them to the U.S. Senate for an impeachment trial. Urgency? That was just another convenient lie. Pelosi's gambit to extort from the Senate her personal approval of the trial procedures was a spectacular blunder. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell refused to capitulate, and the Speaker eventually retreated. But that hasn't stopped the media from fawning all over Nancy Pelosi, featuring her mug on the cover of Time magazine, and extolling her as a brilliant strategist and tactician. In an interview with CBS, the Speaker inflated hyperbole to a new level when she claimed that, quote, what the president did was so much worse than even what Richard Nixon did. It was such a ludicrous comparison, even the reporters seemed shocked into silence. Nixon committed crimes, then sedulously covered them up. Pelosi's articles of impeachment allege no crimes at all. Previously unsupported allegations of bribery and extortion were abandoned by the House. In a different interview, Pelosi told the Washington Post that the impeachment of President Bill Clinton was unnecessary. She seems to have forgotten that Clinton stood accused of 11 felony offenses by an independent counsel. Trump is accused of none. Yet his impeachment is somehow necessary under the new and frivolous Nancy Pelosi standard. The old Pelosi standard was actually the correct one. You may recall that in March of 2019, she stated with confidence, quote, impeachment is so divisive to the country that unless there's something so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan, I don't think we should go down that path because it divides the country. Since then, Pelosi has either suffered an acute case of amnesia or she succumbed to pressure from the liberal wing of her caucus. Either way, the Speaker managed to divide the country in exactly the way she promised she would not. She did it without compelling and overwhelming evidence, but based on witnesses who offered no more than speculation and opinion derived from multiple hearsay.
It's the Perino and Steigerwald I'll Tell You What podcast. Dana Perino of The Five and Fox News political editor Chris Steigerwald dissect the ins and outs of national politics. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Constitutional law professor Jonathan Turley described it to the House Judiciary Committee as not just woefully inadequate, but in some respects dangerous, as the basis for the impeachment of an American president.
Will all senators now stand or remain standing and raise their right hand? Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws, so help you God?
Supreme Court Justice John Roberts has been sworn in to preside over the trial. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and his political counterpart, Democrat Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, are each vowing to address their constitutional duties impartially. But it's clear they have a different view of what evidence should be considered.
This chamber exists precisely, Madam President, so that we can look past the daily dramas and understand how our actions will reverberate for generations. The House's hour is over. The Senate's time is at hand. It's time for this proud body to honor our founding purpose.
In the coming days, each of us, every one of us, Democrat and Republican, will face a choice about whether to begin this trial in the search of truth or in service of the president's desire to cover it up and let history weigh on every one of our shoulders.
The trial will commence in earnest with opening statements from the House managers on the Democrat side, people like Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler. Then the president's legal team will respond. There'll be an opportunity thereafter for senators to pose some questions. After that, the Senate will vote on whether any witnesses should be heard from, especially new witnesses who were never called by the House of Representatives, such as President Trump's former National Security Advisor John Bolton and Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. Many Republicans oppose the introduction of new evidence and new witnesses because that's the job of the House, as Senator Lindsey Graham has pointed out.
Now they want John Bolton to come forward in the Senate to destroy executive privilege. Any president would claim executive privilege over the testimony of their national security advisor. They didn't even subpoena Bolton, and they're expecting us, Republicans, to destroy President Trump's privilege.
They had a chance to call the witnesses they're requesting today. They chose not to because they were in such a rush to do it. Executive privilege applies to these witnesses. I will not violate it.
Republican Senator Ted Cruz has warned that if Democrats insist on calling new witnesses, Republicans would be entitled to reciprocity, calling their own witnesses that were forbidden by House Democrats. The GOP, for example, might call Joe Biden and Hunter Biden, the faux whistleblower, and even Adam Schiff. It's a Pandora's box that might do even more damage to the Democrats' case. The mainstream media, meanwhile, seems to think that a new witness by the name of Lev Parnas, a Rudy Giuliani associate, should be heard from. In an interview with Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, Parnas told the story of how Trump was trying to pressure Ukraine into investigating Joe Biden and his son. But that is already evident from the transcript of the telephone conversation between Presidents Trump and Zelensky, and readily admitted by Trump himself that he did ask Ukraine to hand over any evidence of potential corrupt acts by Joe Biden. Parnas will never be called as a witness. His credibility is highly questionable since he's currently under criminal indictment for campaign finance violations. Moreover, he admits he never even spoke to Donald Trump about it. Like so many other witnesses, he's offering nothing more than speculation based on hearsay. As the Senate hurtles toward an impeachment trial that will likely conclude with an acquittal of Donald Trump, Americans should remember that it was Nancy Pelosi who set this national nightmare into motion. It is an abuse of power driven by arrogance and for political gain. Pelosi bears the responsibility and the blame. I'm Greg Jarrett. Be sure to pick up my new book, Witch Hunt, the story of the greatest mass delusion in American political history.
So coming up next is a good description of the legal team. And this is going to be quite a legal team. And it's got Barry Dershowitz is on there as constitutional expert and so forth. But listen to this report about the legal team that's been appointed. Here we go now.
Who will be on the president's legal team, who you will see during the Senate trial. John Roberts has that story from the North Lawn today. John, good morning.
Bill, good morning to you. It is the same team that we outlined for you a number of weeks ago, and that team now getting ready to go to trial as soon as next week. The White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, will be taking the lead on the arguments for the president, along with Jay Sekulow, his personal attorney. They will also be assisted by two White House deputy counsels, Michael Porpora and Patrick Philbin. And our apologies, we couldn't find a good photograph of either one of them. Sources also tell Fox News the possibility of Alan Dershowitz joining the team for at least part of the trial is still being, quote, seriously discussed. White House officials are confident that through this process, the president is going to be exonerated. Here's the White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley from Fox and Friends this morning.
It has nothing to do with the rule of law by any stretch, because the articles they came up with don't actually cite any crime. It's just to try and smear this president because they know they can't beat him at the ballot box. And I'm well aware it is difficult to run against somebody who has a booming economy, who's destroyed the ISIS caliphate, who's taking out terrorists right and left across this globe. But that's no reason to try and overturn a free and fair election just because you hate the president and don't like the fact he's so successful.
The president has come to embrace the idea of dismissing the case, but at the way that it's going to play out in the Senate is that the House managers will present their case, and then the president's counsel will make their case. Then a possible motion to dismiss will be entertained. This morning, Texas Senator Ted Cruz saying that a vote of not guilty is what he is expecting, and that that, rather than a dismissal, would be better for the president. Listen here.
Dismissal throws the case out without reaching a verdict. So the verdict is going to be not guilty because on the face of it, the articles of impeachment don't meet the constitutional standard. That is a much better outcome for the president to be acquitted of these charges than simply a dismissal.
Now, if Nancy Pelosi hands the articles of impeachment over to the Senate within the next couple of days, that means, as Mike Emanuel mentioned, that a trial could begin as soon as one day next week. And that's when the president is scheduled to be in Davos, Switzerland, for the big economic conference there. White House sources tell me at this point there is no discussion of canceling the president's trip. In think there is some thinking here at the White House, Bill, that it would be better for the president to go on that trip, even if a trial is taking place, because the president could say that he's continuing to do the business of the country while Democrats are trying to take him down. Bill?
Thank you, John. John Roberts, North Lawn there.
The continued unrest in Iran is still sparking criticism at the UN. Here we've got a report of a couple of critics of what's going on and the human rights violations that are occurring. Here we go now.
Well, Athel, Fox News is getting reaction from the Iranian opposition to all this. Prince Reza Pahlavi, the son of the Shah, telling Fox News, quote, "This is not human error. This is a crime against humanity. He who has irresponsibly empowered his thugs to fire at will at innocents bears full responsibility. Enough is enough. Khamenei and his regime must go." The National Union for Democracy in Iran telling us, quote, "They want freedom and dignity brought about by a secular democracy that has friendly relationships with the United States and the world. The Iranian people deserve the support of the United States and its government in their noble struggle for national sovereignty and liberty." And Maryam Rajavi, the leader of the National Council of Resistance of Iran, saying, quote, "All Iranians, especially the youth, express support and solidarity with the families of the victims of this horrific crime by the mullahs. Prosecute and punish those responsible, Ali Khamenei as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, Hassan Rouhani and IRGC commanders."
The Syrian people have seen many sad days, Mr. President, since 2011, but this day is potentially one of the saddest because it is the first time that a Security Council member has chosen to play politics with humanitarian assistance.
That is British Ambassador to the United Nations Karen Pierce dressing down the Russians on Syria, the humanitarian catastrophe that so sadly continues at the hands of Putin, Assad, the Iranians, and General Qassem Soleimani. This is the Iranian people continue to take to the streets in angry defiance of their government, calling for the regime to go. What could happen? Ambassador Pierce joins us now here in the studio. Ambassador, good to see you.
Thank you, Eric.
It's pretty shocking to see these protests growing. We're told that they are chanting death to the dictators, tearing down banners of Soleimani and others. What is your reaction, your government's reaction to what the people or some of the people in Iran are doing?
These are potentially interesting developments. As you say, Iranian protesters taking to the streets after the downing of the airliner. I think it's too early to say what it means, but I think everyone is watching Iran very closely at the moment. I hope it will be another spur to the Iranian government to de-escalate tensions, to stop pursuing nuclear weapons, and, as it were, to come in from the cold. Our Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, has made this call to them. There's a window for diplomacy now. We hope Iran will take it, but only Iran can take that decision. We can't take it for her.
What do you think the Iranian leaders should do? Do you call for meetings? Do you call for discussions about this specifically? What does your government want?
There are very many ways to signal that one is ready for talks. President Trump, Mr. Pompeo, and my own government, Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab, as well as the French, we have all made overtures to the Iranian government suggesting that they take advantage of a diplomatic window that's now appeared and that they come in from the cold. I would think that that sort of thing is normally done quietly in the first instance with senior officials meeting privately, perhaps to prepare a way forward so that leaders can meet. There are many ways of doing it. I think the important thing is that the Iranian government takes a step.
What is the Iranian government doing? Are those overtures reciprocated?
They have sent a variety of messages, but the messages tend to be very in the moment, very transactional. They have not, as far as I know, accepted either the US, French or British offers. We really would urge them to do so. They can see what their own people think of the current situation. Now is a very good time to de-escalate tensions. At the same time, of course, we mustn't take our eye off the nuclear question. We really don't want Iran to require a nuclear weapon.
And of course, the past few months they had protests, and the Iranian regime killed about 1,500 of these protesters, didn't even allow the families to mourn those young people who were killed. The president has tweeted out asking the Iranian government not to kill the protesters. Does your government agree?
Oh, we absolutely agree with that. People have a fundamental human right to freedom of assembly, freedom of expression, and that includes the right to peaceful protest. Now, sometimes those older protests had a variety of motivations, but I think the important thing is that the Iranian government needs to listen to its people, and it needs to de-escalate the current situation, and that's in their hands. We've made our offer.
And one of your colleagues, the British ambassador to Tehran, Rob McCary, went to a vigil. He goes to this vigil for about 15 minutes and leaves, and then they arrest him.
Well, as we've said, as Dominic Raab has said, that is a flagrant violation of international law. There is a convention called the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. It governs what happens to diplomats abroad in countries so they can go about their duties in safety and security, representing their governments. That's what Ambassador McCare was doing. He went to pay his respects at the vigil. It was in honour of the Iranian students who'd lost their lives on the airliner. Quite natural that he should go, especially since British people were killed as well. He then left that gathering when it started to turn into more of a protest, and he went innocently off to have his hair cut, and then the Iranians arrested him.
But he's okay.
He is now okay, thank you. He was released eventually, and we have been in touch with the Iranians to protest very strongly about this breach of international law.
And on Syria, Qassem Soleimani was the mastermind, the so-called terrorist mastermind of this horrendous catastrophe that is there. And you dealt with it in the Security Council, and it still hasn't ended, and the Russians have been blocking some humanitarian aid?
Yes, they have. What happened on Friday was that the Russians, in effect, held the Security Council to ransom. They also held the people of northeastern Syria to ransom because they refused to allow the UN to send aid through what are called cross-border crossings so that you can go into Syria from Turkey, Iraq and other countries without the Syrian government's permission. And the reason that's needed is because the Syrian government will not allow assistance to reach all the communities most in need. It wasn't just General Soleimani, who was instrumental in Syria. I do want again to call out the Russians, but also the Syrian government themselves. Governments are supposed to look after their people, and yet the Syrian government won't issue permits for aid, and they won't help get the aid to people most in need.
And finally, do you feel with the dynamics perhaps changing that the Syria issue and the turmoil will be reduced?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, we had some footage earlier of the sad death of Sultan Qaboos. He has been a very strong moderating force in the Gulf. He has very wise advice for leaders, and he has tried to keep productive working relationships with all sides. I think it's good news that his successor has pledged to continue his foreign policy. Britain has had a relationship with Oman for over 200 years, so we will be in very close touch with them and helping them keep regional stability going.
Well, I know both sides, both governments will be looking and watching out to make sure the protesters are protected.
Absolutely.
In Tehran, and the regime does not resort to what they've done in the past. Ambassador Karen Pierce of the United Kingdom, thank you for coming into the studio today.
Thank you very much, Eric. Always a pleasure.
Coming up next is Greta Thunberg, and she's speaking in Lausanne, Switzerland, right before the Davos meeting. She'll be at the World Economic Forum meeting. It's held annually in Davos, Switzerland. And it brings together hundreds, if not thousands, of different corporations from all over the world. The biggest corporations in the world usually meet there. And they talk about world issues, policies, debt, financing, economic, political, industrial, all kinds of different issues that they discuss there. And this year, they're bringing her in to heighten the environmental problems, issues, and to focus in on that. And then I'm gonna let you listen to this speech that it was just a couple of days ago in Lausanne, Switzerland. Okay, here we go with Greta Thunberg.
Bonjour, Lausanne. Ça va bien? I am so grateful to be here with you, especially now on the anniversary of the strike in Lausanne. And I am so thankful that all of you showed up today with your beautiful faces. Thank you. So, we are now in a new year, and we have entered a new decade. And so far, during this decade, we have seen no signs whatsoever that real climate action is coming. And that has to change. And we have now been striking for a very long time. For well over a year, young people from all across the globe have been school striking for their right to a future every Friday. And for me personally, I think this is week 74 of Fridays for Future protests. We sure have done this for a long time. But we need to make clear that this is just the beginning. Are you okay out there? It started raining now. To the world leaders and those in power, I would like to say that you haven't seen anything yet. You have not seen the last of us. We can assure you that. And that is the message that we will bring to the World Economic Forum in Davos next week. Merci beaucoup.
She will be in Davos. The World Economic Forum is scheduled to begin on January 21st through January 28th. And I believe President Trump will be attending this year also. So he's going to be there at Davos with all these movers and shakers. And what they have planned this year is to take Greta, and she's going to be showcased, you know, as the new young leader of the environmental movement worldwide, the climate change, the climate action movement, see. And they're coupling this climate action, and that's how, what kind of theme that they're describing, that this year, Davos, the World Economic Forum's main theme will be climate action. And what they're doing is they're coupling this climate action with something that they've been working on for years called public-private partnerships, okay? And what happens there is that giant corporations move in and partner with governments which have an unlimited credit line. And then they'll go in and start buying up infrastructure or transferring from the public, ownership of structures, you could say, infrastructure, to their private hands. And this is what Davos is all about. The Bilderberg Group, they have similar goals also. So these are some of the, now this year, like I said, they're bringing in Greta Thunberg and they're pushing this climate action and they're coupling it in their publications. They actually are saying that these two things synergistically are working together to heighten the effectiveness of both, and that the public-private partnerships can carry out this climate action, movement, better. Yeah, you know, those two ideas together are complementary and they can be carried out, like that. So that's something to really look at, very, very carefully. I've been thinking about this world and about the United States. And what is there out there that has been going on? And it has our country been dumbed down? Charlotte Isherby wrote a book called The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America about our education system. A few years ago, I was referred to watching a movie called Idiocracy. Okay. And in watching that movie, it was interesting because, basically it was about Idiocracy was released in 2006. It was an American science fiction comedy film directed by Mike Judge and starring Luke Wilson, Maya Rudolph, and Dax Shepard. And the film tells the story of Joe Bowers Wilson, an American soldier who takes part in a classified military human hibernation experiment only to accidentally awaken. This is a science fiction point of it. He awakens 500 years later in a dystopian society in which commercialism has run rampant and mankind has embraced anti-intellectualism and is devoid of intellectual curiosity, social responsibility, and coherent notions of justice and human rights. Okay, so, you know, this is a film, and they projected it occurring, say, 500 years of in the future, you know, and it's science fiction and all that. But if you look around right now, you know what I mean? We have rampant commercialism, and we've embraced an anti-intellectualism with some of this political correctness. And are we devoid of intellectual curiosity? Or are we just arising for and seizing upon these slogans and sloganeering and so forth? And we have all of these dysfunctional groups, really, is what we have, that are just vying and for their own cult. We've got a lot of people that have fallen into very cultic thinking. And in that cultic thinking, they don't come out of that delusion. I describe it as falling into a deluded state or being conditioned from birth into a delusional state that we never quite ever awaken to, that that's what we're trapped into. But also, I discovered another story that sort of has similar, and I'm gonna talk about that for a few minutes now. And here we go about that. The story, that I found that's similar to this Idiocracy is called The Marching Morons. Okay. And it, if you look it up, if you do a search, on the internet and go into Galaxy Science Fiction, you'll find it on page 128 of that publication. And it's a fascinating story. So, I would recommend that you read that also, but also go out and try to find, Idiocracy. I think you can find it out there if you're looking, carefully. So anyway, that's something to keep in mind is what is wrong with our society and what is really happening and what is it that is causing our problems? Now, Tucker Carlson has one of the most intellectually deep programs on Fox News Network, and he had a recent interview and of 5-6 minutes or so, and he says, what's wrong with this country? And he has a quote by Bloomberg, of all people, saying that California is a model to look for all America to follow. Anyway, listen to this, and that just doesn't ring true today at all, but listen to it and see what you think.
Welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. Say what you want about the 2020 presidential race. It's not what they used to call a managerial election. It's not a contest to determine which branch of the establishment gets a turn at the wheel. This isn't a Clinton-Dole 96 kind of race where you're pretty sure that no matter who wins, things aren't really going to change very much. This year, the one thing you can be certain of is that things could be very different when it's over. The issues at stake are bigger than just the economy or even our foreign policy commitments. 2020 is about the broadest possible questions. What kind of country should we have? Who should live here? What will America look like 50 years from now? There are a lot of possible answers to those questions, but leading Democrats appear to have settled on their position. America, they're telling us, should be a lot more like California. Listen to former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg explain his vision for the country he's hoping to lead.
I think that California can serve as a great example for the rest of this country. You have led the way on climate change, on fighting gun violence, and on criminal justice. And you have, as importantly, opened immigrants with open arms. California is a part of this country that is something the rest of the country looks up to.
So Michael Bloomberg graduated from high school almost 60 years ago, and at that time, a lot of what he just said was true. The rest of the country really did look up to California. Millions of Americans moved to California in search of a better life. It had the nation's best public schools. It had world-class universities that essentially were free. Graduates from those universities created Silicon Valley, among other things, the birthplace of the digital age. Compared to the rest of America, poverty in California then was low, and opportunity was virtually unlimited. The people who moved here in 1960, when Bloomberg graduated high school, found their American dream. But things have changed. Now, the children and grandchildren of those people are fleeing California. We spent the last week here in Los Angeles for the show, and in some ways, it's still a very beautiful place. The western parts of the city are some of the richest neighborhoods in the world. You'd want to live there. They're immaculate, nice people. But huge swaths of modern Los Angeles shock the conscience of anyone who drives by. Filth and disorder and clusters of homeless addicts. Tent cities continue for block after block. This is footage one of our producers, Charlie Cougar, shot yesterday. California has 12% of the world's population, but it has a quarter of this country's homeless. Adjusted for the cost of living, California is the highest poverty rate of any state in America. Nearly a quarter of its people are poor. Why? Well, there are a lot of reasons, but here are some. The state has the most expensive housing in the continental United States. It has the most expensive gasoline, thanks to the taxes. The free world-class universities, those are long gone. The University of California system is some of the highest in-state tuition rates in the country. As we chronicled last week in our series American Dystopia, no city more accurately represents the implosion of California than San Francisco.
Get the f*** out of here,
I've been here 42 years before you're f***ing born.
I'm scared for my safety.
You never know what's coming around the corner.
Yeah, kill me, mother.
Bit into my arm.
I live a block away. You.
This city is messed up. It's very messed up.
I'm not forcing him to move, but I talk to him and encourage him to get to move.
I'll be tenant.
Do you think you'll be homeless for the rest of your life?
Yeah.
You push him out, and then what stays?
It's messed up, really messed up. That's right. And so finally, normal people are leaving California. For decades, this state led the nation in attracting migrants from other states. Now, the flow has reversed. Every year, the number of people leaving California for other places exceeds the number of people moving in by more than 100,000. If it weren't for the constant stream of immigrants from abroad, California's population would be falling and fast. The middle-class utopia of old has evaporated. The state is in crisis. Now, that's obvious to everyone who lives here, certainly, but not to the people who run California. Instead of fixing the problems that are forcing people to flee, politicians here have spent the last few years on policies that are frivolous and counterproductive, banning plastic straws, requiring background checks to buy shotgun shells, legalizing the intentional transmission of HIV. Huh? Governor Gavin Newsom's most recent budget proposes $80 million in additional funding to provide free health care for illegal immigrant seniors. Who wants that? This is the state that Democrats are calling the model for America. The state they want your state to be more like. At least you know what the election is about.
Now, I think that statement by Bloomberg is just so off the wall. It's on the face. It's just wrong. It's not accurate. It's a false statement because California is not the state to emulate. It's not the model that it used to be, like Tucker Carlson was saying and so forth. And I don't want to vote for Bloomberg. I would never vote for him after statements like that. He's a gun control person. He's an authoritarian, gun control, you could say power authoritarian person that was not good for this country. And his statement on California shows that obviously he's out of touch with what's really going on. We've got something happening on January the 20th up in Richmond, Virginia. The governor up there is trying to push through a gun control law that would actually take out the gun rights, the Second Amendment gun rights, the right to keep and bear arms, and it would actually be unconstitutional, we think. There's going to be a big demonstration in the Capitol Square up there, and on January 20th, that's next Monday. But I believe that's Martin Luther King Day, too. But anyway, there's going to be a great crowd of people. And I want to let you listen to what Alex Jones is leading his group up there, his broadcast group. And here's what he had to say in an airport recently on his way to Virginia. Here we go with Alex Jones.
History is happening now. The political planets have aligned. There hasn't been anything in our country's history since the start back in 1776. You can feel it. You can see it. And InfoWars is on the ground covering it. This is incredible. This is reality. We are witnessing a unicorn, leprechaun, Santa Claus, Easter Bunny event. We have the president on trial next week in D.C. while Soros and the deep state, Chi-Com funded, this is mainstream news, are trying to foment gun confiscation and riots and civil war to then remove the president. Everybody, mainline news knows this. So it's not going the way they thought it would go. But we're going to be there. We've got our full crews there. We're going to be in D.C. We're going to be just south of there in Northern Virginia. We're going to be covering it all. This is the real fight for America. This is asymmetrical warfare by the deep state against our country. And so that's what we're doing here is literally involved in the second American Revolution worldwide. The answer to 1984 is 1776. The answer to 1984 is 1776. The answer to 1984 is 1776. And we're doing it. We need all eyes and ears on the ground in Virginia and in D.C. and in the halls of Congress. You know, we the people. Go in there. Witness what's happening. Just have your cameras rolling. You never know what you'll catch when the leftist states some Jesse Smollett type deal. We're counting on you. I know you're going to come through. I want to thank the listeners and viewers of Seven of the Plate. You need to pray for our whole crew up here, Owen, myself, the whole Savannah, you name it. And I need you to financially support us and buy the products at InfoWarsStore.com. That's how we fund all this. And then spread the links. That's how you do it. So thank you all. You're going to get incredible reports at band.video, InfoWars.com. This is the Battle for the Republic, 1776.
Now, there's going to be a big crowd up there. There's been speculation, even on the part of Alex and others, that there might be some kind of a false flag set up to blame the Patriot movement or Patriot groups with some kind of a bad operation or some, you know, very evil going ons or whatever. And so if you're going to go up there, I'd be very careful. And Matt Bracken is cautioning people from attending. And here's what he had to say. Matt Bracken appears on Axios show quite a bit. But here's some advice from Matt Bracken about how to attend, how to be careful if you go up there. So this is some good advice. Here we go now with Matt Bracken.
Okay, I'm on for the rest of the hour. And if you're wondering what I'm going to be mainly talking about today, let me give you a clue. Virginia. That's where I went to school, in Charlottesville at UVA. And I wasn't there for the 2017 Charlottesville festivities, and I'm not planning on being in Richmond this Monday either. I have a pre-existing major social obligation that's been scheduled for many months involving a lot of people. And frankly, you know, I don't think that I don't think it would benefit anybody by my being in Richmond. I think I'll be better off watching from afar and staying out of the what some people are calling the kill box, you know, the kill zone, the L-shaped ambush, the buffalo jump, sort of like a purple bug zapper light for moths that just can't help it. Frankly, you know, I don't want to rain on anybody's parade at this point. If you're going, you're going, right? And over the rest of the hour, I'd like to talk about some of the ideas that I have for making it as successful as it can be, or as it might be, or as we hope it will be, because certainly there are a lot of things that can go seriously haywire there on many levels. And I'm going to talk about some of these risks, but I'm also going to talk about some ideas, some backup plans, some alternate plans, sort of like a quarterback calling an audible. You know, in a football game, the way that defenses are so good and adaptable today, no offense can go up to the line of scrimmage and just say, this is the play. We're running this play. If you see that they're reading you and they're lined up to just nuke that play, you don't go with that play. The quarterback calls an audible and changes the play to adapt to the defense that he's seeing right then. And that's the attitude to take to Richmond if you're going to Richmond. For example, you know, if you think I'm getting into Capitol Square for sure, well, they've already stated that the Capitol Square, that's like the about 6-block area right immediately around the Capitol. That's going to be a gun-free zone, a weapon-free zone. And that means they're going to go through like one gate, a very long line, and a magnetometer, and, you know, like a football game table for your bag check. That's only if you're trying to get into that small Capitol Square. Now, that Capitol Square, it could hold a few thousand people if they let everybody walk all over the grass at the most. But I've seen estimates of anything from 10,000 to 100,000 people showing up. Let's say it's 30,000. That leaves probably, you know, 25,000 people who don't really have a realistic chance of getting into the Capitol Square for lobbying purposes, because that's going to be like the mother of all cattle call lines to go through the baggage and the metal detectors. So don't necessarily plan that you're going to get into Capitol Square. That's the only place right now that's gun free. So if you adapt your plan and you say, you know, I'll be satisfied just being on the outside periphery of the Capitol Square, with, you know, 30,000 or 50,000 other Second Amendment supporters, in that case, you don't necessarily have to be disarmed. But you have to know in advance, I'm not going to get through any metal detector. I'm not planning to get into the Capitol Square. That would be like trying to put Woodstock, you know, inside of a tennis court. It's impossible. It can't work. The numbers wouldn't allow it to work. Now, folks should plan also that there will be major street blockages, and they may not be announced in advance, partly because of just the confusion of the events, the police reacting on the fly as they see the numbers building, or it could be more for nefarious reasons to try to, you know, steer Second Amendment people toward the Mayor Bloomberg, every town gun grabber groups, or a clash, which is what they did in Charlottesville. So you don't plan that you're absolutely going to have a certain route from your car to the event, because you might get to a street and there's a line of police barricades and you got to go many blocks around. So up on this screen right now, I put up an example of a printed map, and I would recommend everybody print your own maps at different scales and mark other routes on them. You'll notice that downtown Richmond area, it's primarily surrounded by highways. That's an impassable barrier for a pedestrian. If you're driving into Richmond, all of the highway exits are going to be primary. If they are up for this, they're going to do the checkpoints right there. And I don't mean necessarily pulling every car over, but they are going to have them slowed down and under close observation. They have been putting up cameras all around downtown Richmond like crazy over the past week. So if your goal is to get to the Capitol Square area and you don't want to be hassled, think about a route that takes you through surface streets. You know, but you're going to need to print out your own maps. Don't plan that you're going to be running around looking at your 4-inch smartphone trying to navigate, you know, under these confusing and potentially dangerous situations if there are anti-fuzz or if somebody shows up to do something terrible there and causes a stampede. So I would recommend everybody actually, you know, physically print out some of your own maps at different scales. Have extras for other people. You know, it's going to be pretty crazy, especially if any of the worst outcomes happen. I read a link to an article today in The Hill. It says that the FBI already arrested a couple of neo-Nazis planning on going to Richmond for, you know, dangerous, violent reasons. Now, I don't trust the FBI. I don't know if what the story is legit, but certainly the FBI is very much on the ball. The SAC, the special agent in charge of Richmond, is a domestic counterintelligence expert, the guy David Archie. He has been studying this. He is on the lookout for any, you know, dangerous actors coming from out of state, hence federal, from out of state into Richmond. So you're going to want to be very careful, as well as, you know, what they're talking all about, the alt-right, dangerous neo-Nazi white nationalist militias. But this is also like blood in the water for other types of sharks. If you think about somebody like James Hodgkinson, who was motivated to go from the Midwest to attack the Republican baseball practice, imagine people like him, you know, losers that are trying to give their life meaning and do something in service of the revolution. What would be better than coming to Richmond to cause trouble? And they might not be very well thought out. You know, it might be a clever false flag, but it might just be some loser yanking out a pistol. Anything can happen in a highly charged atmosphere like this, because this is going to be getting massive national exposure and people are coming from all over the country. And we're going to talk some more about Richmond on Monday when we come back from the break, because there's a lot to talk about. And I have some more ideas about things to do, not just things not to do. All right. Now, I mentioned that if you don't think you're going to be able to get inside of the Capitol Square itself, which is all, you know, fenced off with temporary cyclone fencing now, and trust me, every inch down there is on cameras. If you aren't sure, you'll be wanting to talk to people, have communication with folks that are ahead of you in line. But if it looks like you're not going to get in, and you do decide to carry a concealed weapon, which I know some people are considering this to be a big part of the issue, is just the fact that Northam made this a gun-free zone on his own say-so by declaring a state of emergency. And there's a debate raging right now whether that's legal or not. But trust me, between now and Monday, that's not going to be hashed out. And you're not going to win a debate on the sidewalk, you know, with a cop in riot gear about whether or not it was a legal order for you to carry or not carry a pistol. But that's up to you. But I will say, and this is a lesson from the Twin Peaks, Waco, Texas Twin Peaks disaster. If for any reason, I mean, a truck backfires, if people start pulling out pistols, you have to be aware that on top of the buildings all around this area, these are like 6, 8, 10 floor buildings with flat roofs and parapets. In other words, you know, perfect sniper headquarters, not just hides, but like sniper jamborees. They're going to have every inch of every downtown street covered with spotters and snipers. So if for any reason somebody starts pulling out pistols, think about what happened in Waco at Twin Peaks. As soon as the bikers pulled out the pistols, the snipers unloaded. So really, that's a very bad idea. If you think you're going to get hit by some Antifa or something and you need your pistol, think about the fact that if you pull a pistol, you are going to be in the crosshairs and somebody's going to have about 2 pounds of pressure on a trigger ready to go. So think long and hard about that. I said, people would say, well, then why in the hell would you want to go to a situation like this? Well, for a lot of reasons, there are many patriots that consider this a necessary evolution, a necessary event. Good, bad, or ugly, they've got to go there to show the flag. That not to go to Richmond would be a form of surrender. Another point of view is that, you know, Paul Revere did not lead a march into Boston to protest British gun control. He waited, and then at Lexington and Concord, when the British were strung out, when they were far from their power base, that's when they had the battle, and then they, you know, attacked the British all the way back to Boston. So they waited for the enemy to come onto their territory and into their favorable circumstances.
That was Matt Bracken giving us some very, very good advice. Now I'm going to end it with a couple of notes here about the incoming problem of this impeachment of Trump. One is that the Government Accountability Office issued a report on the 16th stating that they believe that the withholding of funds was illegally done by the president. The other bit of information is that this Parnas gentleman that was associated with Giuliani is coming forward and saying some things that about Trump knowing explicitly what was going on, and he knew what they were up to. And of course, he's up on an indictment on making contributions, illegal campaign contributions. So that's another thing. Getting into this impeachment, now that the Chief Justice has sworn in the senators to impartiality, the question arises, can he break votes, tie votes? I don't know. They're saying he can. And also, can he rule that, yes, they should allow witnesses from both sides? I don't know. My idea was that they should have put forward the rules of this impeachment, the process, before they brought in the Chief Justice whatsoever. But anyway, I want to thank everybody out there for listening. We're in dangerous territory here in many ways. And I hope and pray for all those that go to Richmond. I pray for their safety. And they're standing up for the right thing. I just hope that nothing really bad happens up there. But thank you for listening, and God bless each and every one of you, and good night, and have a wonderful evening. Bye-bye. Good night.